This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Are you there, Sam?
Yep, hang on, I'm just turning that on.
Is our guest ready?
Yep, I've got the music ready.
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, sounds great.
Cool. Otago Access Radio, in partnership with Otago Polytechnic, brings you Blowing Bubbles.
Blowing Bubbles brings you positive conversations with people in their bubbles around the world.
We're curious about how people are finding new ways of life, being and problem solving. Every Wednesday, the Sustainable Lens team of Samuel Mann and Mawera Karatai reach out from our bubbles to chat with interesting and positive people around the world.
Broadcast on Otago Access Radio, 105.4 FM in Dunedin, and streamed and podcast on oar.org.nz.
Bringing joy, connection, kindness and peace in all the days ahead.
Welcome to Blowing Bubbles, positive conversations with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. I'm Samuel Mann, and today I am at Otago Polytechnic with Tim Lynch, chef extraordinaire, researcher to the max, climate change activist on steroids.
Oh, that's your best so far, Sam. That's by far the best. That's definitely going to be my wake up and alarm clock from now on.
So let's catch people up where we are. What are you doing, Tim?
Right, I'm doing a doctorate, and my doctorate's split into three phases as a framework, first being anger, a little being hope, and finally being action. Action being the part where I talk about all the things that I'm actually doing to try and overcome this existential crisis we have called climate change and what that can look like, in my world at least. At the moment, I'm in the hope phase of things, so I've been talking to people to make me, or make themselves, or make us all feel hopeful about what they are doing to try and overcome climate change or try and at least mitigate some of that. So this week I was very fortunate. I went and spoke to a man who makes gin, a subject dear to your heart, I imagine, Sam.
The person you talk to, I have a lot to do with.
So we're talking about Richard from Sandy Mount Distillery. What's unique about Sandy Mount is they're the first distillery in New Zealand. I still think the only distillery that's been given the certification for being carbon neutral. So it's guilt-free booze, if you want. So I managed to pop out and have a look around his distillery, his stills, where he works, ask him some questions, and recorded it. So here we have, this is Rich.
So Richard Wilson. So I started Sandy Mount Distillery. Well, technically I started it in 2020. First bottle sold was in May 21, but prior to that, I'd been hobby distilling in the garage for several years beforehand, and got to the point where I wanted to sell a bottle of gin or something. Ego, right? Just wanted to see it on a shelf somewhere, see my label. But it turned out that it was, you know, I had to get customs controlled area, environmental health, all that kind of stuff. So I bought a pallet of bottles. I thought, well, if it takes me a whole year to sell it, it's just a hobby, just for fun, so be it. But that pallet of bottles sold in 3 months, so shit, I bought two more pallets. And then the second lockdown of COVID happened, and I became an essential service, selling bottles online and delivering them around the city, so I got real busy. Next two pallets moved in a couple of months as well. I thought, ooh, crikey, so I better build a shed. Scope creep, I ended up with this. And then ditched the day job, and that's the start of Sandy Mount. So at the same time, my day job prior to doing this full time was property manager for city council, looking after all council-owned buildings. When COVID hit and all my buildings closed down, except for the residentials, I got seconded over to civil defence. So I was logistics manager for civil defence, so I had a yellow jacket on doing stuff out and about throughout COVID. But at the same time, you know, there'd be days where I'd yellow jacket off, Sandy Mount jacket on, something in a letterbox, you know, making the use of being out and about on the road. So it was quite a busy time, yeah. Why gin? It's really the same answer as anybody else that makes gin. Well, that's not necessarily true. It's quick to turn around. It's the most consumed spirit. So it's cash up, front. You know, within a week, I can make it and sell it. Compared to whiskey and brandy, brandy is the spirit that I love the most. Just released my brandy for the first time this week. But, you know, it takes years. Same with whiskey. So gin is, it's fun because it's really experimental. There's just endless ways of doing it, what you want to throw in the pot. But, yeah, I can get it on the market swiftly. And making gin is actually, as far as the technicality of distilling goes, gin's very easy to make. Anybody can make a gin. It's very hard to make a gin well. So that's kind of what, you know, there's 185 distilleries in the country at the moment. Sandymount was the 60th. So in 4 years, it's, you know, jumped up 300%. And there's about 400 different New Zealand gins out there on the market. And they're all around the $80 mark as well. You know, but supply chain and taxes, we can't afford to be too far off that. The problem is that a good deal of them are still being made by people like me out of their garage with very little controls, and it's some of them are, there's a big span of quality amongst the products out there in the market. So getting to be from a gin maker to a quality gin maker is the bridge. So that's the big risk across the industry, is that all the products cost the same ish, you know, give or take. Now, if you've been drinking Bombay your whole life and you thought, oh, yeah, this New Zealand-made gin craze is catching on, I'll branch out and I'll try one. You spend your $80 on a bottle and you get something that's undrinkable. That's it. I'm not going back to New Zealand-made gin again. So there's a huge amount of risk to the entire industry based on the low barriers of entry for some of the other distillers out there. And there's so many products out there that the next bottle I buy, I want it to be different. And we still see that in gin at the moment. But I do see a lot of brand loyalty with a couple of my products, which is nice to see. You know, the thing is, you can sell any bottle of gin once. To get return business is the sign of, you know, if you're on the right track, whether it be your brand or the product. We were lucky late last year, we won Best Gin in the Country, the New Zealand Spirits Awards. So I've kind of got the comfort that the product's as good as the branding, you know? Yeah.
So the idea of the conversation of sustainability, because it's, you could say it seems somewhat at odds, the notion of sustainability in alcohol.
Mm.
So where did that conversation come from with you?
So it didn't happen. There was no conversation. I was just making things up as I went along, particularly when I started building this. But I came from a background of large commercial buildings where I run sustainable initiatives, you know, getting solar panel initiatives out, running, you know, water treatment, reticulation, pollination corridors, all things like that throughout the city. So I had background in how to build a building from the ground up and what to put in there from the offset. So when I built this, I was going to put solar on the building because I didn't want to pay a power bill, because I knew it was easy to do a new build and look at the ROIs that way. Things like the labels we use on the bottles, they're made from post-consumer waste. I didn't choose that. I liked the texture the most, and they're the same price. Our water reticulation, we're not on mains, I'm on spring water anyway, so I'm naturally going to want to have pumped reticulated water. So all of the decisions that I've made that have led, or the sustainable or environmental decisions that I've done, have been core business decisions first. And then I was previously part of a what's called FMANS, Facility Managers Association New Zealand, on the board of that. My CEO, well, I stepped down off that to focus on the distilling world. My former CEO said, oh, why don't you apply for the sustainability award at our facilities awards? I'm like, why would I? She was like, just get yourself certified. You've done it all already. So I thought, shit, all right. I went out and I, because of that prompt, I thought, yeah, I actually probably am pretty low on my carbon footprint. So I went out and got measured. I chose ECOS as a certifier because they would backdate the measuring rather than Toitū, which would say we'll start measuring now. 3 weeks later, I was certified carbon zero, and I knew I'd measured all my outputs. I knew that I made 11 tons of carbon per year, which is extraordinarily low to begin with. And then I guess that kind of set a bug into me, particularly with telling my peers out there, other business owners, that, hey, there's so many initiatives you can be doing towards your carbon footprint that are actually just better business decisions I've got, even if, I'm, and this is what my PhD is at the moment, is there's a huge what's in it for me from other people. And it's like, well, how about the fact that it might cost you less with some things? It's just smarter. So that's kind of where we're at. It was never a conscious decision. Right, what am I going to do to be carbon sustainable here? It just fell into place organically. Yep, that has absolutely become a brand identity. And I often get told, like, look, I don't have anything on the walls in here that say we're carbon neutral. And that, you know, annoys a lot of people. They're like, why don't you talk more about this? But I remember when I first did become carbon zero, I put a post on Instagram, or I was talking about it to somebody in a conference or something. You know, the next week I got a new listing from Glengarry's. And their first order was like a $4,000 order or something. It, in one order, paid for the cost of getting it. And so I'm like, okay, there has to be a certain amount of talking about it that I do marketing-wise to make this part of the identity. A, because I'm still the first and only carbon zero distillery in the country out of 185. If anything else, talk about it more to push that out. But 2 years later, and still nobody else has done that. So yes, it is an identity now, but there is still an uncomfort level that I have about finding that line of how much do I talk about it, and you know what how much of it stays, you know, like a. You know, I don't want it to be contrived, because yeah. I know I look at other businesses and think the same thing. Oh, yeah, you've done that for the certificate on the wall. So,
let's take your first song, Tim. Who have we got?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but the weather's been good for ducks recently. So I think, like most of Dunedin, I've had the fire lit and I've been sort of sitting beside it, listening to pretty relaxed, mellow music. So I think what we'll do, we'll go through a series of mellow songs for this one. So the first of those is a song called Deaf by a band called Just Mustard.
Thank you.
You asked me at the start if gin was dear to my heart, Tim, and I must confess I am the world's biggest numpty in terms of knowing what spirits are. What's gin?
Right, so gin. Okay, gin basically is you get a base neutral spirit. In this case, ethanol. And then effectively it's flavoured. Now, there's a lot of arguments that come around that the ethanol has to have a percentage of juniper berries in it in order to be called gin. But basically all of those particular botanicals are put into the gin and they're macerated over time and then distilled out. And the residual flavour which is left from the botanicals is what flavours the spirit. One thing about ethanol is it's a really, really effective solvent at stripping out flavours. So one of the things about gin which is really unique is that there's a lot of creativity left to the distiller and what they can put into it. And it's also one of those spirits which is really unique in that often the distillers will borrow influence from their environment. So with Richard, he's actually looking around at his, where he lives at Sandymount, he's looking at the trees that are surrounding him and he's saying, well, how can I incorporate that into it, which gives it a really distinctly unique flavour of that environment. And that's why we've seen this massive sort of proliferation. One of the reasons you've seen this proliferation of gin is because distillers are able to put a very unique footprint onto it to what they have. So with Richard, I mean, he's actually planting out the trees, his native trees, and using the flavours of his gin to guide him with that planting. So one, the environment is feeding into what he does, and what he does is feeding into the environment.
How do you make gin without giving away any secrets?
There's no secrets. So we start off with, I've got two stills. I've got a 100-litre still and a 300-litre still. The 100-litre still runs off 5 kilowatt element, which means on a day like today, I'll be generating 5 kilowatts-ish of power. So I'll run that 3 times a week as opposed to the big still once a week because it's free. Why not do it more often but less? I add an amount, a weight of juniper, coriander, whatever other botanicals are going in that gin, and fill it up into an ethanol mix. It's essentially vodka, 40% ethanol water. Flick it on, bring it up to temperature, which is 78 degrees is the boiling point for ethanol. That starts creating a vapor. The vapor flies up the column. And eventually, depending on how the still's configured, that will make it over to the condenser where it will be cooled down, pushed into liquid again, and falls out the other side as gin. There's lots of different variations on how you can configure that to put botanicals in the vapor path or to have it taller so you get a higher ABV at one end, you know, but that's kind of neither here nor there. So essentially, I'm just boiling a big botanical soup, turning it into vapour and recondensing it down the other end is gin.
So the choice of ingredients, because obviously that's a secret. The choice of ingredients, what is that process
like? I mean, lots and lots of testing. But so for me, I start with almost every single one of my products. In fact, at the moment, I think every single one of the gins starts off with 50% juniper. Now, to be a gin, it doesn't have to be a percentage of juniper. There's kind of two classifications. One is juniper prominent and juniper present. So juniper prominent is a dry gin, juniper present is pretty much anything else, contemporary or flavoured or whatnot. So I run 50% juniper and then 25% coriander seed. That model fits for me, and then the remaining 25% I'll load in with the Coca Forest gin. We use 6 different native botanicals that I find on the property. I started off with 20 different samples of things from 12 different plants and landed on the 6 that I want to use. The reason I did that is because I've got 12 acres that I'm slowly felling all the pines and replacing with natives. I didn't know what natives to plant, so I thought, right, I'll make a gin. I'll see what natives I use, and that will inform what to put back on the property. So I now have those 6. But I do a lot of contract gin for other people as well. They say, oh, you know, we want it to be this profile. But yeah, cool, I'll find some oranges or some chamomile, or I can just make it up. As time goes on, I've got a much bigger library of flavour profiles and know what to use and how to engineer a desired outcome. But really, there's not much you can't do. General rule of thumb, if you can't eat it because it's poisonous, don't distill it. Which is, there's a scary lack of legislation around that. Ambulance is at the bottom of the hill for sure. So that's why you can do so many, you know, every gin's slightly different. Not just because of the botanicals that are in them, but the ratio of weights, the shape, the size of the still, where you make the cuts, your own palate. And it's interesting, like we were saying before, there's a lot of gins out there that I think to myself, does the maker of this product drink at all? Because they must have tasted this before it was released. And it doesn't taste like gin. So you know, your own palate is probably one of the biggest things to be able to determine. Ten other distillers could use the exact same recipe and you'd have 10 different gins. Yeah, so Roots Gin up in Blenheim, Gorseflower is one of their main botanicals. I remember hearing something, I don't know, 10 years ago that invasive species can't be used for commercial purposes. Something like to do with encouraging the... But I know he would have found a way around that, or there's something... But then I think maybe there's pet food companies out there that use rabbits as well. So there must be a loophole in that. But anyway, I never thought... I knew that to be true in my head, so I never continued with it. Banana passion fruit as well. I've got a range of gin where it's entirely sense-led, and I ended up wanting to... I used that in a gin a couple of years ago, but just the once, and it's a bloody nightmare of a thing to use, actually. Terrible. I ended up scrapping it and using a combination of rock melon and mango because it created the flavour profile of the passion fruit better than passion fruit did. Just because you distill something doesn't mean it's going to taste like what it is. Roses, for example, if you distill roses, it comes out tasting like figs.
So you're running the still off solar?
Both solar and grid. So, I mean, a lot of the time... Both. Some days, we're in Dunedin. Some days it's definitely running off grid. But the fact is that I know I'm generating over the space of a year, about 25% more power than what I'm using. So I'm positive in that regards, but for the sake of, usability, I'm still grid tied. So I just run business as normal as if I was grid tied, essentially. Except I might, if it's a sunny day, I might run the still, even if I didn't have a still run scheduled, just because, bugger it, I may as well use it. It's more effective for me or efficient for me to use it when it's happening than sell it back, because I get bugger all for it selling it back. So I am in the market for batteries, it's just a capital thing. So my house runs off the same system. So the one thing I'd like to solve is if I didn't run off the grid at night time for the house, and I could bank some of it, then I would probably be... Like, I still get a $200 a month power bill, despite the fact that I'm positive in my generation, just because the buyback rate's so bad. If I could have a battery for the house at night, then I probably would be entirely in the green for power. It's a supplement. It really is just... I mean, it's a hell of a supplement, but if I get spikes, it doesn't affect me. Because all the stills, if need be, would just be running straight off the mains. So,
so you've hit carbon neutrality,
mm-hmm.
And I see ultimately you'd like to get a carbon zero.
Well, actually, no. So the last certification was carbon zero, and the next one, which I'm just going through the process now, the second count is carbon positivity, but that's not through reduction, that's through offset. Well, the first year was 11 tons to offset, so what's that, $300 bill or something like that. The only other consideration I have around that is I'm buying trees somewhere to be planted, first lot. Most of the options are actually overseas, but it was important to me to be South Island. But there's a split here. So what happens is I do my business practice, I do what I can for my own reduction. Once I get my measurement and I understand how much I generate and what my potential is to reduce, there's a big line in the sand. Okay, that's that job done. I then switch over to the marketing side of things. So when I did my last measure last month, I said, great, you've got 23 tons now. Here's your options of reduction. Here's what you can do to be better for the next year. Cool. That's all I need to know for my business practice. So then I put a different hat on and I say, cool, now I want you to give me the lowest invoice possible to show that I'm carbon positive. It's not. That's a marketing question, whereas reduction is a ops question. Yeah.
Because you're planting out natives out the back, are you able to use them? Obviously, they sequester. Are you able to use those as part of your offset?
The ability to do so is very difficult because to be able to put the guarantees in place that I wouldn't just cut them down again after take the credits and cut them down the next year and plant them again. And quite frankly, there are some plants I fully intend on using just to. Most of it's pulling leaves down, but like the coca tree, I will actually top. hoping, you know, they do regenerate very well, but I'm going to mess with them. So no, I'm planting the property for my own purposes rather than, no. Technically I could, I'm choosing not to. I know because I got to pick where my trees went, which last lot went into Nelson and I think the next lot are going on to Banks Peninsula. I think most of the options was like Fiji or something like that. But yes, in principle, that could be the case. And essentially, the carbon credits retailers, so to speak, can pick, you know, can sell you trees from overseas. They cost less. You know, where it's $49 or $60, whatever it is, for the New Zealand plantings, it might be $10 less to go overseas. So some people, you know, will take that option. Because the paper on your wall is the same at the end of it, right? So, yeah.
This is a really complicated thing.
Mm.
Offsetting's complicated,
mm-hmm.
carbon calculation's complicated,
mm-hmm.
businesses are complicated.
Mm-hmm.
You put all this together, it's a big, noisy mess. Obviously, you can't possibly have done it all on your own. Who did you work with?
Well, so the first time round was ECOS. They were our carbon certifiers 2-3 years ago, whenever we first did it. I don't know. I knew very little. I had done a lot of work in the space, but in large commercial scales, and I'd never gone through the calculator in enough detail to be able to do it myself. Also, I just don't need to. There's people out there that do this, right? So it doesn't have to be difficult. In the most recent, when I did it last month, used a different outfit than ECOS, and wow, it was easy. As a business owner, they came in, they interviewed me for 20 minutes, give me a rough idea of how this business works. How many staff you got? What are your main freights? Can I see your P&L? And your power bills. A week later, they'd done my full report. You know, measuring's not that difficult. And this is a message that I spend a lot of time telling any small to medium business, not just in the distilling sector, is the best thing anybody can do is you don't even need to change anything. Hopefully you will, but you don't. If you just measure, if you just ask somebody to help, and you can do it online. There's all sorts of ways of doing it, from simple to complicated. But if you just measure and know where you are, it will highlight some low-hanging fruit. The first time I did it, I went to ask my freight company, what's my third-party footprint through freight. They couldn't answer the question. They didn't know. They didn't measure it. So I changed supplier to, who did I move to? Toll. Moved from Toll to PBT. And they're like, oh, yeah, absolutely. We measure this quite closely. We have our own reductions. Just changing one supplier because they could answer the question made a massive difference. So my third-party freight is quite a big part of my footprint. So just changing that supplier made a huge difference to my overall tonnage. So... And I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to change anything I do. So you learn that through measuring. So that's not the question you asked. You asked, do I have help doing it? DCC are also great. They want to throw resources to get Dunedin businesses to do something. So 3 months ago, they sent out an email saying we are trying to encourage Dunedin business owners to measure. Awesome. It was actually unclear what the hell they were talking about. But I said, I'm in. Whatever it is, I'm in. I want to be a part of this. It turned out they were just asking for volunteers, people to put their hands up. They paid for the third-party measuring, which was, I can't even remember what they're called now. I should, because they're who I'm credited through now. Where I did it with ECOS, it cost me about $2,000. This time it was free, because DCC foot the bill, because they want to see us doing better. So absolutely, that's an awesome move on their part. They had a dozen people take them up on it. It's crazy. You know, there should have been 200.
Do you think, so that's at like a regional level. Do you think there's an onus on the federal government to
Yeah, definitely. And I think the communication in this area is at ends. Yeah, and my theory behind this is because it hasn't been working, the approach of the, let's call Group A the carbon conscious. Now, they might be policy makers, they might be certifiers, they might be anybody that's trying to create a carbon difference, and they're speaking a language, and the people that they're speaking to, the what we want to be the adopters, aren't listening And I think there's a few different reasons why that language barrier is breaking down. One, I think, is a lot of the business owners are looking at a what's in it for me. And so they need to see more proof, and this is how the market responds to you putting this. If you don't care about the environment, this is how the market responds anyway. If you, or here's how it affects your bottom line, like the what's in it for me. But the other thing is cultural differences.
Mention of the government means we need to have another mellow song.
Yeah, I think so. I don't want to get political, particularly with this government. So this song's called Pulling Our Weight, and it's by a band called the Radio Department.
Listening to Blowing Bubbles, I'm Samuel Mann, talking with Tim Lynch, who has been out to talk with Richard Wilson at Sandymount Distillery. Tim, Richard makes lots of points about the order of which things, and it's almost the priority order of operations and marketing. And I think he's saying that sustainability comes about best if it's a sensible way of doing business rather than as some add-on or you're just doing it for marketing.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was in Bornholm and I was talking to the Scandinavian businesses about it, their whole premise was it just makes business sense. And this is sort of an avenue that Richard's really coming at from it. It's like all of these things that he's doing, all these small sort of incremental things, when they're adding up, they're not only helping his business, they're putting him in a fairly niche position. If you can imagine, he's charging $70 for a bottle of gin, which in my universe is certainly on the high side of a bottle of spirits, not really being a spirits drinker too much myself. But anything which is going to allow him to occupy that premium space is beneficial to him. And so in his case, and he's doing this without cynicism or not being cynical about it, he's doing it in a way which is in line with who he is as a person, and that's falling into his business. So if, I think for him, it's the same thing that the Scandos were saying, is that this just makes perfect sense for our business. Why would we not operate this way? Because it's allowing us to operate our business in a more efficient, more effective way, and for us to reach a whole group of people that ordinarily may not hear our story or what it is that we're trying to do.
Is his premium that he's able to operate in because he's working sustainably, or is it just that it tastes nice?
I think it's both of those things. It's a very good gin. He makes an exceptionally good gin. I don't think as a business as Richard said, you know, anyone can sell a bottle of gin. You can sell the first bottle of gin. It's selling the ones after that. So people may buy the first bottle of gin because it's based on sustainability. They may well do that, but they won't buy the second one because it's based on sustainability. Now, if you look at the uptake of his gin sales, it shows that not only is he able to communicate the story of sustainability, which is allowing for that first initial sale, but people are coming back because it's a quality product in and of itself as well. And I think that's the critical thing, is having both of those mechanisms working simultaneously and being able to communicate that to the customer.
Is it luck or management that sustainability tastes nicer?
I actually don't believe there's any luck in it at all. Because if you think about sort of sustainability in food, food that has got a less of a carbon footprint or a shorter supply chain to it is fresher and tastes better. If you think people arguably will say that organic herbs taste better and fresher than non-organic herbs. If you think of all of these things, I don't think it's so much luck. I think it's just that often these foods taste better because of it is. If Richard is using botanicals that are drawn from within a 50-metre radius of where he's distilling his spirit, they're going to be fresher, they're going to be tastier, they're going to have a higher sort of flavour profile to them than if he was getting things sent to him from halfway around the world. Now, obviously, juniper he has to get shipped on, there's no way around that to make it a gin. But all the other notes that make it uniquely of that environment are from his farm, effectively. So I think it's both.
I think he's successfully managing to take sustainability from being a thing about doing less to actually he's doing more.
No, he's doing a whole lot more. And the thing that was really interesting was the complexity of his business model and the way that he was able to weave his business model into A, the product, but B, the environment that he works in. There was, when I was sitting there after we'd finished recording, there was this beautiful moment where his... we said, look, this is what it's about. And we looked out the window and it was this distillery manager was walking down to start her shift. And as she was walking down there, she was being chased by a flock of chickens because she feeds them each day. And for him, that was what it's about. In a lot of ways, that symbolises Sandyman Distillery, that combination of product, environment. Sustainability is the linchpin which enables all of those things to operate simultaneously. So there's a synergy within all of those things and how they operate. They're not mutually exclusive. And I think that's where Richard's been really clever with his business, is he's been able to see how you can overlap all of these different things. The environment, his business, a lifestyle, his well-being, his integration into the community of practice, his longevity as a businessman, and his longevity as a human being and happiness. He's managed to forge all of those into a single business model, making a product that he really loves.
He's making alcohol, though. I don't know if there's a bucket that we can put it into, not the alcohol, the business, into a bucket. Like, it's not fair to put it in the same bucket as smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, there were questions about that. And I you know, because you can't help it. You can't make booze and claim sustainability and not expect someone to poke you in the ribs about it and say, well, you hang on. And, well, to his credit, he had answers for that as well. And he had rationalised that in his product as well. It's very easy to be cynical, I think, about people making gin. But, I mean, the reality is New Zealand as a nation, we're the master of like small businesses. This is what we do. We make cottage industry, cottage style businesses. You know, small businesses that are agile and responsive and of that environment and of that area. We're not very good at scaling them up, and we're certainly not good at taking them internationally. That's not what we do at all. But for Richard, it's booze. So for himself, you know, he's had to rationalise this, and he has, as to, you know, irrespective of it being a premium product, how does he have a clear conscience about selling booze effectively?
The health harm cost of spirits, just because we're premium spirits, a lot of premium spirits producers put their head in the sand and say, I'm not the problem here, I'm not cheap wine or RTDs. It's not the case at all, actually. But the embarrassing thing is how little funding is put towards the $9 billion worth of harm. I think it's about $60 million worth of taxes are actually going towards that. So in the subject of sustainability, not environmental but social, is something that I started at the very start of Sandy Mount, which is to actually, well, we will offset. I, you know, did the calculations to figure out how much of each bottle should be going to our proportion of that harm cost. And so we're actually in this process this month of Women's Refuge, Volunteer Fire Brigade and local schools. All areas that really don't gel well with alcohol. So me as an alcohol producer, I've got 10 ton of firewood going out off the property. You know, I've cut down over the year and I distribute out to some of the key places out there that are probably most impacted by alcohol harm in the community. And that's our social sustainability, if you like. Now that's one that, even though you've got a microphone in my face, I will do zero PR around that. That's not something that we have any ambition to. We will not market that because it's more of a personal gripe. A couple of years ago, I was working with a group. I was on the other side of the Healthy Homes initiative, and there was money. There was money out there up for grabs, interest-free loans for installation, grants for heat pumps, grants. Government had created a fund where a few organisations had access to give free money or free installation to people, and the public didn't trust it. They're like, don't believe it, nothing comes for free. So part of a group which wasn't run by council, but Aaron Hawkins was chairing it at the time when he was in the mayor. And it was like, how can we tackle this problem of actually turning up to people's houses and saying, no, honest, it's just please take it. We've got the Healthy Homes coming and we want to be living in a healthy built environment. Getting people to onboard it was actually the most difficult part of the whole task. And when you get given a grant or a capital fund, there really is pressure to spend every year or get lower. They'll only give you as much as you spent next year. If you can't spend it all, we won't give it to you. So there's a lot of stress. Like we need to get people to actually trust that there's good things out there. What a bizarre.
So what does success for Sandy Mount Gym look like?
So 4 years ago when I started, I wrote a 3-year business plan, which I knocked almost everything over on it on the first 6 months, which says I didn't know how to write an accurate business plan. But the purpose for me is I live here. I've got this fantastic property. I built myself a lifestyle business. I set up my plant and equipment with. I know that there's a ceiling on how much product I can make per year. It's about 16,000 bottles. What success looks like for me is for me to enjoy my lifestyle as a distillery owner and live on this property. For my staff to the buy-in from them is huge. So I, to have proud staff is a measure of success for me. Hard to measure, but it is still one, a marker of success. And for the brand itself, for the product itself to be seen as a quality leader, something that my team and I talk about all the time is that these things, these gins, they are a vehicle. They are the fuel in the tank to afford us to transform the property. One of my main objectives is actually just to transform this 14 acres into a full native planting. The gin affords us to do things like that. The gin affords us to, engage in a sustainable conversation. So it's kind of in two sides. Whilst I want my products to be seen as an absolute marker of quality in this country or internationally, it affords me to have everything outside of those doors that I like doing, this is the vehicle.
So what role do you think distilleries or food producers can play in helping people less sort of fearful or powerless from climate change?
I'm not sure that my answer to that is specific to distilleries, producers. I think it's an attitude that my industry can adopt, but any business owner attitude can achieve the same thing. And I think it's just a subject of momentum. I think we're still in a phase where there's we had the initial pioneers on a sustainable movement. We're still only in the stage of the early adopters, and I think once the quantity of business owners, distilleries or other, it grows big enough, then we move from early adopters into, you know, it's like a bell curve. We move to the mass of people moving, and that momentum will start. People will start feeling like, oh shit, I'm the odd one out now. So the more, yeah, I don't think it's distillery specific. I think it's anybody who creates a product or a brand.
And that's what makes you hopeful for the future?
I never said I was hopeful for the future. No, I am. It is because I do see firsthand the people that engage with me because of this reason. I do see it's a small percentage of the customers, but the people that see it and like it, the way they engage and the way they're so pleased to hear and think it's amazing what we're doing, I can see that, you know, slowly that mass of people that appreciate it is going to grow. And like I said, if I stop thinking about the individual difference I make, what my 20 tons of carbon, you know, or if I can reduce that to 12, if I stop thinking about how much difference am I making on a carbon scale, it's quite insignificant. How much difference can I make convincing other people or showing other people what I'm doing to onboard more people and get that momentum? It's more impactful than my individual carbon contribution.
Thank you, Richard. Tim, we said at the start you're writing your doctorate about making changes in culinary education. What have we learned?
Well, what we've learned is that business models need to evolve and they need to change. The notion of sustainability is shifted and is more subtle and nuanced, but also it's an opportunity. And if we think of like the way Sandyman Distillery is viewing sustainability, it's as a tool. It's as a way to evolve and change his business practices and to create a business which has long-term viability. And if we start viewing that notion of sustainability as a tool in food production and start applying to other areas, I think there's a lot that the wider food production system or mechanisms could take on board for these things. What we sort of obsess over with food is because it's generally viewed as a commodity and as such has the lowest value associated to any other product, is we need to do it in bulk and volume. And in that case, corners need to be cut. There's no way around it. If you want to make a lot of something and you want to sell it off cheaply, you need to make an awful lot of it. Whereas where Sandy Mount and Richard are coming from, it's like, well, we can only make X amount of this and that is it. And if you think of that question in and of itself, in the wider picture of New Zealand's agriculture, we can only have so many cows. We can only have so many sheep. You know, we're at kind of peak agriculture as it stands at the moment. So the question that Richard's asking and that New Zealand needs to be sort of trying to answer is how do we extract as much value from that finite amount of resources that we're at?
You were talking about scaling small businesses, and I think what you're suggesting is that it would be a mistake for Richard to try and scale and is producing, what did he say, 16,000 bottles?
Yeah, 16,000.
Seems like a big pile of bottles, but it would be a mistake to try and make that 160,000.
Yeah, and I think the notion of scaling also needs to be changed. There was a carbon neutral lamb producer, Providence Lamb, we've recently sold, David Cruxley, who had it, and I mean, up in the I can't remember, it was up the Waitaki Valley. The way he wanted to scale his business to make it bigger, because he was completely carbon neutral because he wasn't using any agrochems or anything like that, was to get other farmers to operate like him. So his notion of scalability was showing that this is how you create value and this is how you extract the maximum of value for your farm. So in the space of the time that we were using Providence Lamb, they expanded. First it was just him, then another couple of farmers and another few more farmers, and to join the brand under the umbrella of how to operate. And I think for New Zealand, the notion of scalability doesn't necessarily have to mean that you just need to make more and more and more. It can mean that you export the knowledge or the idea or the IP or facilitate how other people can operate in a similar way. And I think that's where New Zealand's really very, very good at. And I think that's where the opportunity lies for, you know, small business producers that are agile, that are able to react and respond to changing environments and customer preferences, is the ability to sell that knowledge and not necessarily the product.
How do we avoid falling into the trap of the kiwi fruit, where we sell so much knowledge that the other people get really good at doing it?
Well, the issue...
Yeah, maybe that's okay. We want them to.
Well, I suppose, you know, Zespri is a really interesting example because they put a lot of time, money, resource into what they were doing, and then they didn't secure the copyright for it. So free markets being free markets, they just took the word Zespri and ran with it. So how do we avoid doing that? Well, you just need to be clever. You know, we need to be smarter. We need to work smarter, not harder. We also need to accept that, you know, I asked my, you know, my second year class of 20, and I said, how many here are going to stay in New Zealand when you finish your degree? And I got three people. And of the three people, two of them were maybes. So I think as a nation, maybe one of the things that we have to accept is that what we are really, really good at doing is exporting knowledge. We're already doing it. We're already training these incredible people like with an amazing set of skills so they can go off into the wider world and use it. Maybe, and I'm just saying hypothetically, maybe their exporting of knowledge is something that we need to start looking more and more at.
And in your case, if we can get them to be sustainable chefs, then that could have a much bigger impact.
That's the hope.
Who are we going out to today?
Well, we're going to finish off with the Mellow selection for Rainy Sundays. So this guy's called Josh Davies. He's probably better known as this guy called DJ Shadow. And in 1996, he brought out an album that got in the Guinness Book of Records for being the first album of all time that is solely made up of samples. He didn't play any instruments whatsoever on this. He did it in his lounge on a sampler which had a 13 second memory, which by modern standards is unbelievable. And this is one of the songs from that, and it's called Midnight in a Perfect World.
Insight, foresight, more sight. The clock on the wall reads a quarter past midnight.
You've been listening to Blowing Bubbles, a conversation with people in their bubbles, their safe spaces around the world. We're broadcast on Otago Access Radio every Wednesday afternoon at 3 and streamed and podcast on opar.org.nz. Tim Lynch was joined by Richard Wilson. I'm Samuel Mann. That was Blowing Bubbles. We hope you enjoyed the show. Mate wai.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.